really understood the pricelessness of time until I experienced my first long cycle of fatigue. Not just being a bit sleepy, but fatigued. I had about 4 hours of sleep, 4 hours of awake time sometimes, which in that 4 hours of awake time, I would have to use strategically. And it had to be the right 4 hours. If it was the wrong time of day, my shoulders would feel heavy and I couldn't stand for very long. If something got in the way, if the cat meowed for food at the wrong time, if I needed a nap, my 4 hours would get disrupted. Now, the condition that I have is a profound form of hypothyroidism that resulted from a series of benign masses in my throat and subsequent surgeries. It's really complicated. I won't tell you much more about it, except that I am close to now what healthy might be on the inside as much as I look healthy on the outside. And that's been the status quo for about 5 years. I wouldn't put myself in the high-risk COVID-19 category, but 6 years ago, I definitely would have been there. I also know that being a graduate student or professor or minister has protected me from a lot of the immediate economic issues that my friends and those over 100 million people with chronic illnesses and those coping with COVID-19 layoffs in the United States may be facing right now. The hours on hold, even just to get care covered, can use up all the spoons for the day. So what is it about these spoons? The first part of my message this morning is a story by Christina Miserando called Spoon Theory. Christina is the author of a group on Facebook now called But You Don't Look Sick. She has fibromyalgia and lupus. And in 2003, she created this story of a conversation, much like we see these cartoons having here on my slide, a conversation with her best friend in college, in which they went from talking about music or trivial things and got serious about Christina's illness. This story took off in the chronic illness and invisible disability communities, or among spoonies. And so I wish to share with you this story, as I think it has some relevance actually to the things that we are facing today as a society. So here is a shortened version of Christina's story told from her perspective. And if you have your spoons with you, you're welcome to play along with me. Christina tells this story. She was sitting and talking over French fries with her friend Samantha. As I went to take some of my medicine, she says, and a snack, as I usually did, Samantha watched me with this awkward kind of stare, instead of just continuing the conversation. She then asked me out of the blue, what does it feel like to have lupus and be sick? I was shocked, not only because she asked this random question, we're just trying to have a snack, but also because I assumed she knew all there was to know about what it meant to have lupus, what it was like to be me. She came to doctors with me. She saw me walk with a cane sometimes. She had seen me cry in pain. What else was there to know? I started to ramble on about pills and aches and pains, but she kept pursuing and didn't seem satisfied with my answers. She asked what it felt like, not physically, but what it felt like to be me. to be sick. Christina wrote that she thought to herself in that moment, how do I answer a question that I've never been able to answer for myself? If I can't explain this to my best friend, how could I explain my world to anyone else? And at that moment, the spoon theory was born. Christina says she quickly grabbed every spoon on the table. Heck, she grabbed every spoon from everyone else's table. She held them in her hand like this lovely bouquet, looked Samantha in the eyes and said, "Here you go. You have lupus." She looked at me slightly confused, as anyone would if they were being handed a bunch of spoons. I asked her to count them. I explained that when you are healthy, you expect to have a never-ending supply of spoons. But now when you have to plan your day, you need to know exactly how many spoons you're starting with. It doesn't guarantee that you might not just lose some along the way, but at least helps to know where you are starting. So she counted out 12 spoons. She laughed and said, "But I want more of them." I said, "No." And she looked disappointed. "I've wanted more spoons for years and I haven't found a way to get more. Why should you?" I also told her that she would have to always be conscious of how many spoons she had and not to drop one accidentally, because she wouldn't be able to get it back and she would never be able to forget that she had lupus. I asked her to list off the tasks of her day, including the most simple. She started rattling off daily chores or just fun things to do, and I explained how each one of these things would cost a spoon. When she started out with jumping into just getting ready for work, I cut her off and took a spoon away. I said, "No, you don't just get up. You have to crack open an eye and then realize you're late. You didn't sleep well the night before. You have to crawl out of bed and then make yourself breakfast before you can do anything else. Because if you don't, you can't take your medicine. And if you don't take your medicine, well, you might as well just give up all the spoons for today and for tomorrow as well." I took away a spoon and she realized she hadn't even gotten dressed yet. Showering cost a spoon. Getting dressed was another spoon. You can't just simply throw on clothes when you're sick. You have to make the decision about what your temperature is, whether hands hurt and buttons are just not agreeable. I think she started to understand when she theoretically didn't even get to work and she was left with only 6 spoons. I explained to her that she needed to choose the rest of her day wisely, because once your spoons are gone, they're gone. Sometimes you can borrow against tomorrow's spoons, but just think how hard tomorrow might be starting with less. You don't want to run low on spoons because you never know when you will truly need them. We went through the rest of the day and she slowly learned that skipping lunch might cost a spoon, as well as standing on a train or even typing at her computer for too long. She was forced to make choices and think of things differently. When we got to the end of her pretend day, she said, "You know, I'm really hungry." I summarized that she had to eat dinner, but with only 1 spoon left. If she cooked, she might not have enough energy to clean the pots. If she went out, she might be too tired to drive home safely. I rarely saw Samantha emotional, and I didn't want my friend to be upset. But at the same time, I was happy to think finally someone understood me a little bit. She had tears in her eyes and asked, "Christine, how do you do it? Do you really do this every day?" I explained that some days were worse than others, Christine said. "Some days I have more spoons than most." I handed her a spoon that I'd been holding in reserve. I said, I've learned to live life with an extra spoon in my back pocket for reserve. You need to always be prepared, Christina said. Now, Christina's story ends on a hopeful note. She writes, walking out of the diner, she gave Samantha a hug. I had that final spoon in my hand and I said, don't worry. I see some parts of this as a blessing. I've been forced to think of everything I do. Do you know how many spoons people waste? I don't have any room for wasted time or wasted spoons, and I choose to spend this time, this spoon, with you. I am so grateful to Christina and to all the other spoonies who are willing to share their stories so that our loved ones can understand us and believe us, so that those who have chronic illnesses and have new language to explain the many choices we make throughout the day, so that we all might learn what has gotten people who have been physically distancing, taking bed days, or counting spoons, and lead lives full of joy and beauty and strength before anyone ever heard of the coronavirus. Rabbi Elliot Kukla, who lives with chronic illness, will be hosting a Passover Seder this week, as many will, a meal to gather and commemorate the liberation of the Israelites from slavery. In the past, he said, Seders were spent figuring out how to precariously arrange my chair and pile of cushions in such a way that I could sit that long without too much pain or fatigue. Seders usually led to pain flare-ups. But this year, it feels like the whole Jewish community is coming over to meet him where he lives. He shares that sheltering in place has somewhat broken down the isolation of illness as the rest of the world, the rest of our world, learns the tools that sick people have always had for staying connected from home. People who have been living with long-term illnesses have had to learn the skills to negotiate and protect themselves, especially at a time like this. Social distancing for people who routinely live with a compromised immune system. This has been a survival mechanism for a long time. Self-isolating has already become a norm for people who may experience chemical sensitivities from things in our environment or asthma from polluted air. Working from home for many was already a common request to an employer. Tools for slowing down, for meditating like our labyrinth today, were already a matter of shared practice. Creating smaller circles of care, phone trees, and ride shares, always a part of mobilizing support when you have a chronic condition. Rabbi Kukla says that these skills are so needed in this moment, and are beginning to be adopted by our culture at large. Look at us here, worshiping on Zoom. Of course, the news about why we are all having to do this might get us down. One thing that spoonies can teach the rest of us is to be able to accept the pain and the sadness as reality, and to prepare ourselves to grieve the losses of time, contact, and lives, to feel our feelings, to learn new ways, new varieties of love, new ways to be beautiful and strong. I'd like to play you a video of a song that was first produced by a post-rock band from Canada called the Silver Mountain Zion Memorial Orchestra and Tra-La-La Band. It goes something like this, and I hope that you will sing along with the recording. When the world is sick, can no one be well? But I dreamt we were all beautiful and strong. When the world is sick, can't no one be well? But I dreamt we were all beautiful and strong. How many spoons are you finding yourself with this morning? Maybe you'll let us know in the chat. Sitting and feeling your bones, your muscles. What wisdom are they sharing with you right now? Where do you feel beautiful and strong? Where can you send in our community, in the community beyond this Zoom room, your prayers for beauty and strength? When the ancient Israelites left slavery in Egypt, Rabbi Kukla writes, they did not head immediately to the promised land, flowing with milk and honey. Instead, they set off into the arid wilderness, unsure where they were going or what they would find. As satyrs come and go this year, we too would find ourselves in a wilderness. We are in new, uncertain territory, as we have shared with one another each week in these services, where many of the economic and social structures of the old world are no longer relevant. Like the actual desert, what makes moments of transition so unnerving and so filled with potential are the wide open spaces, the huge arching sky and expansive sandy plains of the desert. Rabbi Kukla continues, this virus is neither a blessing nor a divine lesson, but I do hope that we don't return to exactly what our pre-coronavirus lives were. We can be navigators of this uncertainty. Leah Lakshmi Piepsna Samaransanma. I'm going to try that again. Leah Lakshmi Piepsna Samaransanma, author of this book called Care Work, which I recommend so strongly, writes about the possibilities that people with chronic illnesses, with long-term conditions, have had for years. That today we are finding they are sharing the knowledge that being sick or disabled has taught us. For years awaiting the apocalypse, I have worried, she writes, that as sick and disabled people, we may be ones who are abandoned. But I am dreaming the biggest disabled dream of my life, she says. Dreaming of not just a revolutionary movement in which we are not abandoned, but of a movement in which we lead the way. With all of our crazy, adaptive, devised, loving kinship and commitment to each other, we will leave no one behind as we roll, limp, stim, sign, and move in a million ways toward co-creating the decolonial living future. I am dreaming, she concludes, like my life depends on it. And now I'd like to share with you a brief meditation by Reverend Jason Cook, who is just down the road from some of us in Fullerton, before we sing again. There is a clarion call of good news emanating from my heart, a call that so surrounds me, so fills my ear with its ring, so cradles my soul with its sound, that I sometimes fail to hear it. Awash with the devastation of living, the cutting edge of bad news, of our world, of life's greatest challenges, of our failures as humans, of our flaws and longings and recklessness, I sometimes cannot hear that call. It is not because my ears don't work well. Well, they don't, but that's another story. Another piece of news that so many of us share, whether it be our eyes or limbs or lungs that suffer. Our bodies and their fragility, no one is spared the vulnerability of being human. And all are vulnerable to what may come, that which reminds us shatteringly at our core of our humanness. So how easy, in this world of a cacophony of news, of so many voices, including our own, expressing doubt, distrust, fear, anxiety. It's so easy, he writes, to miss the sound that resonates with our soul. Perhaps it's not a sound, really. Perhaps it's a vibration, and I am not quite in harmony with it. Perhaps if I stay in the middle of all that noise, I will feel it, resonant and strong from somewhere, within and without at once. Good news flowing through me. The good news that is me, that is you, that is us, that is our earth, that is our universe, that is as deep as space and as light, and life-giving as breath. That's itself.